Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to the front three. It's good to have you. Although tonight it's only a front two. Lawrence McKenna and Kristen Hennage joins me. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, good. Two of the original members. No Dave, no Adam tonight. You know, those two frauds. Two guys. I'm joking. There is plenty of football to discuss. Not only is the international break unfolding and England unfolding with it, but there's plenty of transfer speculation, et cetera, going on, which I don't know, seems to be what a lot of people are into. Chris, you put out a tweet before the show, which actually looked quite popular. Lots of good questions on there. I'm more interested, though, in what you consider to be kind of the big talking point of this week. You and I have both been discussing transfers back and forth. Mm-hmm. But what's been your big take?
Yeah, I think it's been almost impossible to avoid the Messi situation, which I think in turn bleeds into the transfer market as a whole and how it's become. It feels just like this summer, maybe because it's a condensed schedule and everything's a bit truncated, but it just feels like it's become such pageantry this summer, almost as if like you're just watching a stage play being acted through social media.
Yeah, of course. And part of it for me is also the vernacular that people are using around it, which is kind of, how can I put it, sort of, you know, there is intent on the player's side. The player wants to leave. You know, there's potentially a transfer here. There is, you know, the only thing that needs to be agreed now is the transfer fee. In principle, this is happening. Part of me just kind of wonders if there's a better way of basically just saying, look, the player's holding the shirt. That's it. Before that, shut up.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the problem, is that it feels to me like it's become just an extension of public relations, or I guess client journalism, to use another term, whereby these people that have built this reputation on being transfer specialists, in inverted commas, are so either so desperate to have that scoop that they will claim things that maybe they haven't found themselves, or they've sourced from the reports of others.
Right.
Or by the same token, they maybe know that what they're being given is not the most honest information, but they're happy to play that game. It just seems like actually there's the smoke and mirrors is not in trying to find the truth, it's in trying to find what is potentially the most clickable. And I hate
part of being a journalist. Yeah. Part of being a journalist now is growing your brand. And I get there were journalist brands back in the day, but you know, there's very much a sort of being a person who's in the know, or being a person who's kind of, you know, close to an agent or close to a player or any of these kind of things. And I mean, I guess when we look back in the future, we're going to kind of go, God, why don't we have like a bullshit meter on transfers? Or why don't we have, you know, something which held people to account? Everyone seems to have forgotten about fake news. I believe it is still a thing.
Yeah, and I think that's my concern, is that it feels like we almost don't really care what's said anymore as long as we hear something. Like you'll see someone tweet something, a writer tweet something about this transfer story, and underneath it's just a like a swarm of, like a school of fish, just any news on this, any news on this. And the obsession with getting a new player in seems to overtake almost the football club itself and the institution and everything else. Maybe I'm looking at this through a very anglicized lens because it feels like it's talked about a lot more there. And I don't have the experience of knowing what Bundesliga fans in Germany or, you know, Ligue 1 fans in France talk about.
But it is a sensational. And often, I guess what you find is that the back pages are almost a practice of what the front the techniques that the front pages will use in a few years' time. I guess a couple of years ago, we saw a lot more infographics being used on the back pages. Now we see the front pages using a lot more infographics, a lot more creative layouts, et cetera, et cetera. We see transfer rumors. And then after a while, rumors and political things like that seem to be a lot more prevalent. People in the back pages basically thinking it's okay to lie because, you know, it makes news, that then becoming very much about the front pages as well. So I'll be interested to see if Fabrizio Romano gets inside news on Donald Trump's election anytime soon, or not. Who knows? Maybe he'll get it direct from another source that finds it out themselves as well.
And the irony, the irony is not lost on me that we are now discussing it ourselves, so adding another layer of that on top.
Yeah, meta.
Yeah, and the reason I think that's relevant is because this Messi story is theoretically huge because it's someone leaving a club that he is part of the very fabric of and has helped elevate to the position that it rests in. But at the same time, I see a video, but I see it essentially outlining what his father had for dinner in Barcelona. And it's like, I don't know if that's...
Is that really a thing?
Yeah. It's maybe it's the nerd in me creeping out where I'm more interested in, well, actually, where would he even fit at Manchester City, theoretically? Like, I just think there are different ways that we could do this, different things we could look at and talk about that don't necessarily revolve around the disposable nature of tracking a transfer that, for the most part, I likened it to being a waiter at times because you leave the table with an order and by the time you get to the kitchen, they could have changed what they wanted or what's being offered to them. It's so complicated in that regard. I don't envy anyone that has to try and source these things because it is a bit of a fool's errand sometimes, in my opinion.
Well, it's also something where clearly a few people within that setup are very au fait with using the media in the first place, or very au fait with seeding things and knowing that that will probably have an influence overall on the way that people react. Maybe even floating it as, you know, Messi wants to leave. How can we generate some transfer, interest from that? Not only that, but, you know, how can we put pressure on the club to re-sign him at a higher contract, or to get rid of the people that we want, or to show what the real story is here. It's very strange because it isn't just about one thing anymore. When a player says, I want to leave, the player is also indirectly saying, well, you know, I'd like to leave if this guy's still here, but obviously, you know, if this guy leaves, then I could stick around. That seems to be what they're saying with Bartomeu right now.
Yeah. And that goes back to kind of what I think I had said before, that for me, there are just certain twigs that feel reminiscent of Sergio Ramos's potential departure from Real Madrid a few years ago, the almost annual event with Cristiano Ronaldo in Real Madrid where he would talk about wanting to leave or not feeling valued and a new contract would come. I think Messi's end game with this is potentially more structural changes. Although saying that, at this point, we're speculating on what he's thinking, when in actuality, I think it's fairly normal for someone that has spent that long at one club, that place, to want some kind of change, to not even feel comfortable waiting for that change because he knows that, you know, his time at the top, if you will, is decreasing because he is 33. And if he can get that guarantee of, I think, which City have talked about, or what has been reported is several years at City, a transition to New York City FC and MLS, and then, you know, maybe even a year at Newell's potentially if he fancies that. it seems to be a much more structured path with a greater intent to it than what's being talked about at Barcelona changing.
Well, but at the same time, part of me also wonders, I mean, you know, I know Barcelona aren't totally in the power here, but maybe they see the massive commercial benefits of having Messi, and, you know, it probably is hugely beneficial to have the image rights to such a player, or, you know, being able to at least put him on a poster or something globally. But part of me wonders whether the part of the problem, part of what Messi is almost rebelling against, is the fact that football doesn't seem to be the first thought always on the Barcelona minds at the top. And the club isn't really being run in football terms right now. It's actually being run in business terms. And he seems to be the face of the business, which is obviously fantastic. So he's maybe exercising his right. But part of me also wonder whether it is actually best for Barcelona to move on at this point.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment to make as well, is that when you consider just how gargantuan his wages are, and yes, some of that will be toppled by the sponsorship deals and things that he brings in, it does feel as if this could be the perfect time for both to separate. I think the problem you have with that is it's a little bit like these one club players that we see in England with, say, Steven Gerrard or Jamie Carragher, where you're almost thinking about that legacy as much as anything. Is could you, let's say Newell's Old Boys aside, just because, you know, that's where he's from and there's a special attachment to that club, could you see him playing for any other club in Europe? The thought of him playing against Barcelona in some kind of competitive fixture seems unthinkable, would have been unthinkable 12, 24 months ago. And I think that's where this becomes such a complicated matter, is you do have to assess the legacy as much as kind of what will be the short-term financial gain.
And part of that is also supplemented by the fact that there is that video online of the kid who's saying, "Messi, you'll be dead to me," in the same way as, you know, Thiago Alcantara is, in the same way as anyone else who left the club in this time. And that it is kind of strange because, I mean, I guess in the moment, obviously, people feel very strongly about things. But even outside of that, you know, part of me is wondering, Chris, I mean, I'm not saying Messi isn't a fantastic player, but Barcelona had a fantastic infrastructure anyway, pre-Messi. Part of me wonders whether they have not sacrificed so much, but how do I put it? The luxury of Messi, the silk sheets within which they have rested, which is Messi for years, maybe has misled them a little bit as to where the club should be or is. And actually, they would have been better going down the route of trying to develop players and, you know, come up with their own stars, these kind of things. That I get it, Messi is a star of that, but at the same time, should they have almost banked on Messi? Because it's strange, because I mean, you know, they bought Coutinho and players like that. It seems that they've also slightly led themselves down this route where they've gone, well, you know, we'll go down the star led route, okay, we'll buy Suarez, Coutinho, Neymar, all these guys, and then suddenly they've gone, oh no, actually we don't want to do that, we'll go down another route. It's been so misguided and there's been so little planning in it. It almost feels it feels a bit stupid at this point. They've gotten to this point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that goes back to what we talked about with those legacy players, that there is a point where you become beholden to them. And it's not that Messi is a bad player all of a sudden. I think it's more, how do you accommodate him tactically? We've seen that manifest in a few different ways where they've gone for 4-4-2s. And they've gone for him as a false nine. And nothing has quite worked, I think, to the same efficiency as before. And that in itself is a difficult thing to try and wrestle with, because, you know, you could argue it's like those marriages that don't end in a big explosion. They end sort of quite quietly. It's not that they don't necessarily want to be United anymore. It's more a case of it just doesn't work for either party. And I think that's where, again, to lean back on that legacy thing, if Barcelona hadn't fought for him to stay and had just said, yeah, okay, go, that would be seen as almost disloyal. And so much of this, I think, is managing the optics. And that is something that we forget, I think.
Yeah, I get that. I guess I'm also slightly just disappointed overall by the fact that it's happening. Sometimes, I guess, there feels like there is a lot of potential in a Messi or someone like that. And sometimes you would like to see, I don't know, you'd almost want to see that that player might have to be traded somewhere else or, you know, whatever, which I quite enjoy sometimes in NFL or NBA or any of these things when you see a salary cap or whatever. And it would be interesting to see what would happen if, you know, Messi was to go to a Napoli or to go to a, you know, not an Everton, but, a, you know, an Inter, somewhere like that. It makes for kind of fascinating just thought exercise in the first place, right? Which is partly why people like it as journalists, because they can write endless articles about Messi, the past, what Argentinians have done, what Barcelona have done, what Inter Milan would do. What there are so many different articles, I guess. There's so much. There's a well for content for weeks.
Yeah, without doubt, and I think that's almost how in an odd way he feeds the situation, regardless of what he does, whether he stays, there will be think pieces about why he stayed, and there will be people talking off the record about why he stayed and things like that. And that is what I talk about when I say the pageantry. It's not all bad, but it certainly feels like the further we get into this game, the more we discuss everything that goes on around it rather than just the actual football. And it's an interesting change, I guess, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Should we go down some of the replies? Because I think the replies actually lead a pretty good running order for us. Let's start off with one of the two Zaldivar twins. It is, with all the messy things going on, prompted me to think of the question, what football moments have made you cry? I guess it is a very natural segue off the messy bit. Have you cried a lot at football, Chris?
You'd be surprised given some of the stuff I've had to watch as a Newcastle fan. I think the closest I've come have been Peter Lovenkrantz scoring, I think it was just days after his father passed away. And it had been, I think, maybe 2 months since my own mother had passed away. So there was a sense of empathy there that sort of transcended any sport in that moment, that he could kind of focus on that. And then Jonas Gutierrez after his battle with cancer, because we were lucky enough, you and I and our good friend Mark Speller, to sit in a room with him for a little bit. And I think what is always interesting to me is seeing how people change when they see a red light. And I didn't see that with Jonas. I saw someone that was consistent in his character, and I think more than anything, just really loved that football club. I mean, he has a tattoo sort of saying as much, commemorating Newcastle. So I think to see not only him survive that battle that he had personally, but then to come back and to be so influential in keeping the club up, knowing they weren't really going to re-sign him, knowing or not knowing at that point, but to later learn that via a phone call, it was very touching to see that at least someone at that club you knew cared without question.
Yeah, and obviously two kind of incredibly not easy to relate to, but, you know, moments which you'd imagine a lot of people would say, yeah, I can understand that one. I'm just trying to think of moments which have made me... Not many is going to compare to what you've just listed there, I don't think.
I mean, there was the recent title win. Was there any moment at that?
Oh, actually, you know what? Yeah, I mean, I guess with everything that's just been going on, I think recently a lot of people are very emotional. I think I actually kind of... it's kind of funny because I think normal people on a daily basis can't sit in front of a camera and maybe feel normal, but I feel like I've spent so much time in front of the camera now. Whether that be to a lot of people or a few people, that you don't forget it's there, but you feel a lot more natural maybe expressing yourself on it. And it's kind of strange because Liverpool won the league and I genuinely kind of broke down just thinking of everything that had gone on in my life and in the people's lives. And I really was struck by how a lot of people died during COVID in that moment, and sort of thought, how sad it was that some people didn't quite make it to the point where they saw their club win that last title before they would pass away. Mm. And I think that, strangely, that brought a tear to my eye, despite not knowing directly at that point anyway, someone who passed away from COVID. And then, strangely, the other one, which really, the other sporting moment, which really made me cry and is still an incredibly emotional topic, I think, is Kobe Bryant. And I'm still not quite sure why, because, you know, I didn't grow up in the same way as I grew up with, you know, a Steven Gerrard or someone like that. But for some strange reason, there's something about, obviously, I think probably the circumstances, probably a lot of, I don't know, late nights spent watching the Lakers or NBA 2K and things like that, which I guess have kind of influenced what I felt. But it's still a very kind of touchy subject. But in terms of football's crying, I didn't actually cry during 2005, the Champions League final. And I've not cried when we won the Champions League. I'll be honest, Kristen, it's because it feels so natural.
if you can,
people will love that. I think that's, and people understand what parody. Let us know on Twitter what your favorite moment in terms of high emotion was. Crying with happiness doesn't quite count. I think it probably is sad moment. Do you think people? I mean, do you think a player leaving a club like a Messi or someone is reason to cry? I guess if you attach a lot of emotion to him and you've got a lot of memories that you feel incredibly bonded to him with. The closest I ever came to that was probably Fernando Torres, I think, just because I felt so sad as to how it ended. It felt like a relationship with someone, you know, everyone has a relationship in their life where they're like, ah, if only we could have made this work. And then years later they go, yeah, that was never going to work. But ultimately, you know, you're happy when you see them with the next person winning the Champions League. I've had a lot of strange relationships in my life. Did you have that about, I mean, apart from Jonas? Shearer didn't really leave, did he, at an emotional point?
In the same way. I think, no.
Do you ever cry at Mike Ashley, over Mike Ashley? Do you ever just think, God, the wasted potential of Newcastle United?
Not gotten to the point of tears, but I think there's been days where I've been apathetic, which is arguably worse because you don't feel anything. And I think the first time they were relegated, I wanted nothing to do with any of them. And I'd never felt that before. So that was a very new feeling. And I think it's kind of the same with when you talk about players leaving. I think not exclusively, but almost always, it tends to be a player from your childhood. Because I think that's when there's an innocence attached to your love of the team and the player. And I think it's without realizing sometimes them leaving is as much an acknowledgement of the passage of time as it is anything else.
Right.
And so.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
That's kind of when I think of now, I look back on sort of the championship season of 2009. When I was a much younger man at university, and the 96 season when I was a kid and my priorities were so much more different. I don't want to sound too jaded when I talk about this stuff, but when, you know, there was, when your life was just a lot different. And I think that is where that comes from. I think as you get older, you sort of accept that players, especially these days, are a lot more transient, that they're just there for a moment. And It might even sound cruel of me to say this, but you're almost anticipating their departure no sooner than they've arrived.
Yeah, I guess there are certain players, maybe as well, that is partly what you feel when you're at a club where you feel like you have to sell at some point. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I see what you're saying, though. Maybe I feel a little bit like that with Thiago. I can't quite work that out. It's a strange one. There are a lot of... there's a lot of emotion, attached to players when you're young, strangely. I guess because you look up to them in a weird way. But weirdly, I wish I hadn't looked up to Robbie Fowler because of his hair, or Michael Owen. I think a lot of young guys had the Michael Owen hair. And if you can't remember, we don't mean Michael Owen hair now, which is obviously probably the haircut of a middle-aged man. We mean the haircut of a young boy who's clearly just brushed it all forward with gel and then weirdly sort of parted it. Like if you did that now, people would be like, what is wrong with you? Why have you done your hair like that? But at the time, it seemed so natural. Am I right, Chris, or no?
Yeah, it was very much of the time, I think.
Yeah, and couldn't be any more of that time. Well done, he's 14. There are a couple of other good questions here as well. Luke Dorr says, is it a real blow if Liverpool do not make any more signings? When he says any more, he means after the one backup left back that they did. Or do you have to just trust the process?
What do you think?
I'm kind of interested to hear what the outsider's take is here, Chris, because the insider's take can go in multiple different directions. But the outsider's take could be a more fascinating one than, Elton John over here.
Well, I think we talk a lot about players being like a new signing when they've been injured for a while. And these players haven't been injured, but Curtis Jones, Rhian Brewster, Harvey Elliott, Kiana Hoover, there to me is a quartet of young players that have sort of dipped in and out of the first team. Brewster was obviously at Swansea last season for a tiny bit and did very well, actually looked really good.
And when they were trying to get up, yeah.
Yeah, and I just wonder if, as much as there is a sort of temptation to sign players, and we talked about this a lot when Spurs didn't sign anyone, that, oh, actually, they've kind of benefited from the continuity a bit. That was the pro
right.
opinion.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think where Liverpool would benefit is that means they could start to transition that quartet of youngsters in there and give them more opportunities, because I think actually that you do gain something from that pressure. It does. I think it does sort of build you up in a way that, as good as Championship football week to week is, it's a different kind of development, in my opinion. And I think as long as they don't fall into the trap of you're just around the first team and you fall into this sort of development limbo where you're not playing for the youths, you're not playing for the first team, they should be okay. And that's where I personally think if Klopp just throws those four in and starts to give them more trust, then I think it'll be fine.
I've got to admit, it's less that I'm worried about the talent drop off at Liverpool, because I think there are a few guys who are still within their peak years. For me, it's more the fatigue and the not familiarity breeding contempt, but that kind of a feeling around the squad, and also just the fact that then if the spine begin to become frustrated, what happens then? The midfield still, to me, strangely, as much as we've said Klopp has built a fantastic side, which is true, still doesn't really have the structure that I think it needs alongside Fabinho. And there are sometimes games where it can feel like it passes Fabinho by, possibly because the structure around him doesn't quite feel right. Obviously Liverpool played Arsenal and it was a game which you can probably make 1,000 different excuses for. But the fact is that Liverpool team should have at one point expected to quite comfortably beat a team, no disrespect to Arsenal, but Arsenal's point in their transition. Mikel Arteta has done a great job, I guess, of bringing that team forward and especially injecting them with a lot of confidence. And I think Liverpool, it's not their confidence is low, but I do think they're a little bit more aware that right now there are people who could pick at their soft underbelly of, you know, possibly not having all the right pieces in midfield. Salah not looking particularly confident. Mane looking a bit frustrated. There are also some very obvious defensive issues in there, such as Robertson and Van Dijk looking like a scary pairing on one side, and obviously that naturally leading to people targeting what is considered a weaker side in Trent and Gomez, and therefore there being sometimes a bit of an overload on one side, and obviously that being not impossible, much more difficult situation to defend, and also then that, you know, with Trent bombing forward, sometimes that naturally leaves Gomez or whoever wide open.
Does that disappear with Thiago for you, or does it need to be more than that?
Thiago obviously has great pressing stats at Bayern. I think he's, you know, he had very good pressing stats just compared to the rest of Europe in terms of players. He was also great at transitioning the play and making some very insightful passes. If I'm honest, I don't know if that's my top choice as a signing. And if we've got 30 million, we definitely have close to 52 million, which could have been Timo Werner. I also think there's so much more to come from a Naby Keita or a Minamino or, like you say, a Curtis Jones or someone like that. I guess I'm a little bit concerned that we don't quite know where all these pieces fit right now. And also that with Jordan Henderson as the captain right now, which clearly is what Jurgen Klopp wants and clearly what Jurgen Klopp has kind of worked towards, how we structure the midfield. Because I think that is the real issue right now. Liverpool's only real game plan is either to press and to win the ball, which obviously has happened a fair amount in the Klopp, but also to maybe make a bit of a cheeky foul when the players are breaking through on goal. So a Fabinho or a Wijnaldum picks up a foul. Thiago may help to ease that and probably transition the ball through midfield in a more silky fashion. But I am also concerned that it is fatigue that will set in at some point, and we'll just see the players not begin to burn out, but in a similar way to Dortmund, begin to not maybe feel the same element of creativity in the moment or the same predisposition to run in the same way as they did before. There was also an interesting, fascinating article I read today. Forgive me, I can't remember who the writer was, but he was talking about the use of caffeine products by Liverpool, which is interesting. I couldn't work out whether it was whether he was alluding to something else. But he was saying naturally, due to the way that Liverpool have kept their players stimulated, there will be a drop off because they're coming towards the end of the stimulus cycle. And therefore, you should expect Man City to easily walk the league this season. I mean, can you see Liverpool dropping outside of the top four, though, Chris?
No, not that far. That feels way too far.
Am I right in thinking, I mean, there isn't this feeling that they'll win the league again? But then there is also the feeling that people had before with Klopp's side, where they said, well, Dortmund won't win the league back-to-back, and they did start the season poorly, and then Klopp did, inevitably, due to the story, turn it around.
Yeah, it's an interesting position for Klopp to be in now, because he is sort of the favourite. He has to guard the title rather than attempt to break through the castle wall, so to speak. I think we've already seen, even as early as we are into pre-season, if you can even say that about this weird situation we're in, seen teams try to press Liverpool a bit more now and sort of apply that pressure. I think it's not less fear, but I think there's more of an acceptance that you have to be proactive against them.
Right, exactly, yeah. And, you know, I think especially at one point there becomes a fear of losing, but then after a while of that team winning, it becomes more of, well, if they're going to win anyway, we might as well attack them and give it our best. Mm-hmm. And that then begins to turn over. I think Arteta played it fantastically, and actually played it fantastically twice against Klopp in a month. But you know, maybe not all managers will be able to do that. And, you know, maybe we also have to accept that Liverpool won by some very fine margins not long ago. What do you think about the, I mean, who, I know it's kind of silly to ask you who Liverpool should have signed, but do you think, I mean, Thiago is one silky player. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure he solves the problems. I personally would have liked someone to switch up the attacking lineup, and I personally would have liked Timo Werner. But then maybe I'm just being too hopeful.
No, I don't dislike that move at all. I think what is intriguing to me and says a lot about where the respective clubs are that Liverpool could, in theory, sign Thiago and ship Gini Wijnaldum out for roughly the same figure. That's not a slant on Gini Wijnaldum, I should say. I think he's been a very good player for Liverpool. And the role that he's been moulded into has actually been very impressive to watch, because I was a bit sceptical on him after watching him for a season at Newcastle, just because he had a tendency to disappear. And I thought that's going to be even more pronounced at a big club if he doesn't sort that, because of just the way it is. So, yeah, I think there's just part of me that thinks, you know what, Brewster is one of these young players that has had to be patient for a little bit, I think, in terms of he wanted to play like yesterday. I think he'd have been happy to start at 15 years old if you'd asked him to. And the temptation is to throw him in just because of how that Swansea form went. But I think the path for a development of a young player is never linear. And so if you can't get Werner, then I don't think Brewster is a bad trade-off for that. I actually think that you don't necessarily want to disturb the rhythm of that front three. Great podcast. And so that's where Brewster could actually serve as a sort of symbiotic solution to that, where he can come in and offer you something. I think the only thing I would warn Klopp against is just throwing him on whenever they're losing, because that is just such an awful position for a young player to come into.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the same time, if Liverpool had have brought someone like that in, maybe it would again sort of signal to the people in the, you know, the maybe the Harry Wilson cycle, those kind of things, that again is another set of players who maybe Liverpool have brought through their academy and aren't going to play at all. But I've got to be honest, I can't, it's not that I'm negative about the way that Liverpool are being, but I'm not, it doesn't leave me feeling confident as a fan, and a fan who at this point feels like Liverpool should be capitalising while they can, to be honest, rather than just thinking, well, this is a God-given right. It's more Liverpool need to do it whilst there is impetus to win the title, because the concern for me is it might be very difficult to build back up to that point without Klopp, and especially if we end the relationship with Klopp on a bit of a sour note in a similar way to the way that Dortmund did. Which comfortably leads me on, Kristen, to another documentary of, I guess, a club where things were a little bit sour at one point, but maybe I falsely assumed from the outside that Jose Mourinho would sour them further. David says, have you watched the Spurs All or Nothing series? We're obviously not watched the whole thing because you can't binge watch it, strangely. But Chris, the first three episodes are out. Mm-hmm. I have watched one and two. I'm assuming you've watched one, two and three.
I have indeed.
Thoughts? Oh, you haven't?
No, I have. I've watched all three.
All right. Okay. Thoughts on Jose Mourinho's propaganda machine?
Well, look, I think we have to acknowledge that first and foremost, these are marketing materials for the most part. They're heavily influenced by the subject in terms of Daniel Levy will get final say on these things. And I think that was one of the accusations thrown at the Man City one, was that it became very bland and like a brochure rather than an actual documentary, because it sounds bad coming from a Newcastle fan. What football fans really want to see is a Sunderland till I die. They want to see things implode. And even then, truth be told, the second season of Sunderland till I die, I didn't really enjoy it because I didn't feel like I actually heard anything from the players. It was just these two David Brent-esque owners sort of tearing about the place.
What I can say about the first three episodes is it feels like, to me, Mourinho is very desperately trying to build a bond with his players. And yet, at the same time, he seems to create an odd distance with them through it being about him. So,
do you think he was kinder than I maybe thought? He had a different air to the maybe the air that I expected from Mourinho.
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, just because he brings Harry Kane into the room and his pitch to Harry Kane is, look, you want to be a star, you want to win things. I think people don't rate English players. They think the league is great, but they think, what is it? He says the movie stars come from other countries or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And you're like, great.
Good line.
Yeah, strong start, brilliant. And then he sort of goes, I'm pretty big time as well. I don't know. It's sort of, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm pretty special as well. And it's just, I just think it's not about you in that sense. I get him saying that, you know, I think I can help you unlock there. You know, I've worked with XYZ and what have you. I feel like
Melito, Eto, yeah. I mean, Drogba, yeah.
I feel like I have seen what it takes, and I can show that to you. You know, that kind of thing. And it's just, I don't know. I feel like he's the internal struggle I see with Mourinho is the need to be personable and connect with players, because I think his default is I'm going to challenge them, and either it highlights their frailty and I can move them on because the owner sees that as well. Or it either spurs them on to prove me wrong or serves as an epiphany and they do it either way. So the win's always for Mourinho. At least that's how I think he views it. And I think what he's starting to realize is actually things have changed. And when you do that to several players, they can potentially form a clique. And before you know it, you're out on your ear. So he's trying to like build more of a kind of bond in the way that, you know, like he tells Dele Alli, I think you're a lazy trainer. And Dele Alli laughs, and I'm a bit like, I'd be mortified if my manager said that in front of me. But, you know, horses for courses and all that stuff for all different people. But I just think that that's the thing that I've taken from it. It's that internal struggle of him trying to stick true to his methods that got him there, but adapt to the way that football has changed just from a man management standpoint.
Yeah, it was quite fascinating, actually, to see Mourinho's techniques, I guess, but also how quickly he turned it around. And maybe I'd sort of forgotten that, because I think Spurs felt a little bit like one of the forgotten teams this season in the rest of the league. Maybe I'm wrong. But it didn't seem like there was so much focus on them because there were other people with a, you know, maybe a more sexy manager like Frank Lampard or someone like that, or there was more focus on Manchester United's resurgence, et cetera, or even the Wolves or something like that. So it is pretty fascinating to watch, and it's changing my perspective on both Spurs and Jose Mourinho. Although, yeah, when it comes down to documentary making, again, whilst it is great to capture this stuff, I'm not always sure it's the most incisive documentary, but maybe it feels insightful in some sense. It feels closer than I felt, but not as close as I'd like to be or as much as I'd like to see. We can, I guess, seamlessly transition into Chelsea. A couple of questions about Chelsea. There was actually two questions. One from James, who says, what are the expectations for Chelsea in this coming up upcoming season? And then there was also one from Dara White, who says, will Chelsea actually challenge for the title this season? Both good questions, Chris. Similar vibes. Will Chelsea challenge for, I mean, you know, maybe it's a stupid unbinary question that I'm asking you, but do you think Chelsea have got the potential to up their game to such a significant level this season?
They have the potential. It's how Lampard straddles the balance of that team that I'm curious about.
Yeah, right, because it's all attackers.
Yeah, as you look at the build-up of the squad, the strength is ultimately in the attack. And yet, I think at the same time, the trouble they have is defensively, it's a bit more frail.
Right. Because they're very unsure about a number of things. For instance, the goalkeeper. For instance, how to set up the back line. And I think a lot of people part of me is curious, Chris, whether because of the way that Liverpool have obviously won the title, obviously that impacts a little bit on what people think of as how you can win a title. Now, obviously, down the years, there have been a lot of big players that people have signed. But it hasn't always been that someone signed a massive centre-back and then gone on to win a title. That just so happens to be what Liverpool have done with Virgil van Dijk. Seems that a lot of people now are sort of billing Koulibaly as that kind of a player. I know he's possibly more likely to go to City at this point or somewhere else. But people seem to be talking about needing to bring in someone to bring some order into that back line.
Yeah, I think any team with a struggling defence or one that is not at the level desired seems to think that there is a Virgil van Dijk out there who can just bring all of the notes in line on the music. And I think, I mean, look, if you had said, you know, 3 years ago or 5 years ago, Liverpool are going to win the title with a left back from Hull City, a central defender from Southampton, you know, another defender from Charlton and an academy player, you'd sort of be looked at quite funny. But
and the £65 million goalkeeper from Roma, yeah.
Yeah, the random Brazilian goalkeeper that they got from Roma for a hefty fee. I think...
Yeah, that's a better way of billing it, isn't it? Yeah, would you ever, if anyone had said, which club would you get a really good goalkeeper from that will end up winning you A, the Champions League, B, the title, no one would have said Roma.
I think that's where you have to give Klopp some credit. I think in some ways that opens a wider debate about how dismissive we can be of where we actually sign players from and how we can be a bit elitist in that regard. But I think you have to give Klopp credit for the way that he built this team in such a robust way that actually they were very defensively sound. And I think that's where Lampard is at right now, is that he has experimented a bit. He's introduced some young players. Granted, he didn't have a transfer window last year. They kept their powder dry in January. But now he's got several big players. At the time of recording, Havertz is apparently on the way. Thiago Silva is incredibly experienced. I don't think he will play 60 games next season. I think he'll be more of a rotational player. But Timo Werner, Hakim Ziyech, they have signed big players in a summer when, to be truthful, I think every team is feeling the impact of Corona and reduced revenue streams. So you could argue there's an element of pressure on them to win something. I think the pressure is on Lampard to look convincing. That's what I think it is, that we need to be here in 12 months and say, yeah, we know exactly how Chelsea play. We know their style. We know what needs to sort of potentially come in that next transfer window to make it the perfect team. I think at the minute he's still a few steps away from that, and so that's his goal almost.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I'll be interested to see what Lampard can do with this side, because they are an exciting team, not only on paper but also in real life. And obviously Werner is incredibly exciting as a player, as is he. You know, you've listed most of those so far, and I think the progression of this side is what is also very exciting. They feel like they're at the beginning of a curve, should we put it that way? And with or without Lampard, I think a lot of people will be very excited to see the way that this Chelsea team go. Although it is interesting, Chris, to see all the claims that someone like Lampard is actually quite a big pull for players, because a lot of players feel maybe a little bit tempted when they speak to Lampard. But maybe I can't work out whether people are just correlating Lampard being the manager with Chelsea being the only club in Europe really willing to spend this level of money.
Well, I think the thing is, his career was recent enough that a number of these players will have grown up watching him. So I think that plays into it as well. This is not someone dusting off black and white photos. He's still very fresh in the memory. And I think his ability to relate to those players, because he is so recently retired, I think you saw it at Derby. There was a number of young players in that squad that seemed to benefit from his presence. And to be fair, as good as we're going to say the likes of Christian Pulisic, who I know wasn't an academy graduate, but a young player that they brought in, Fikeo Tomori, I know he had a rough sort of end to the season, but looked good in periods. Mason Mount, Tammy Abraham. As much as we can talk about their talent propelling them there, I think he's managed them well at the same time. And I think he has been able to garner a trust from them that I think is indicative of his managerial ability. I don't think he's as bad as some of his critics want to paint out.
Right. I understand that side as well. A lot of very exciting managers in the league, though. I think this is probably the most excited I've been for a lot of managers in years. We're interested to see where Ole Gunnar Solskjaer goes. We're interested to see where, when I say goes, I mean with this project, not necessarily when he leaves. We're interested to see what happens with Lampard. It's kind of coming towards the end of a cycle for two massive managers in the league, in Pep and Klopp. And then there's Mikel Arteta, who seems to be like a silent influence on that Arsenal side, or more silent possibly than the Klopps or the Peps out there. So it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, Arteta fascinates me generally just because he's taken a squad that I think had a lot of bent pipes in it and straightened them out. If I was an Arsenal fan, I think I'd have driven Xhaka to any club that he wanted to go to. And yet now he looks a lot more serviceable under Arteta. I think what made him so good at Gladbach, which was his ability to pass well on transition and make the most of spaces, that's something Arteta's identified and used, I think, quite well during his brief time. I think a little bit like Lampard in that sense. I know he's had less time, but he has established an identity, I think, quite quickly. And they're very much at the start of that curve in terms of his progression. So my hopes are quite high for Arsenal this year. I'm worried they'll disappoint me, but I think if I was a fan of that team, I'd be full of optimism going into the season.
Yeah, I felt that the same after watching them towards the end of the Premier League season and also just seeing the tone of the players. I don't think we've seen that kind of tone or feel around the club or that level of expectation or even that level of positivity, which it seems like the players are actually excited to play for Arteta, whereas maybe before they weren't as excited to play for other managers, should we put it that way. I'm trying to think of the best way to finish the podcast here, Chris. We will make our top four and relegation predictions next week, pre-actual season. Who did Newcastle kick off against?
West Ham. Battle of the basket cases.
Yeah, a bit of a weird one. Are you, just while we're here, are you expecting that you guys will be an absolute basket case this season?
Yeah, I have a concern that actually we might prop the league up this year. Last season it was a bit more, could be 14th, could be 19th, not too sure. But they just got a pasting off Middlesbrough the other day, 5-1. They haven't signed a striker yet at the time of recording. So far, Jeff Hendrick and a third choice goalkeeper are what they've got to show for it. I just don't really rate Steve Bruce's ability to put together a modern tactical system with detail and intricacy. I think he's a bit more broad brushstroke, and I don't know if that works in the top flight anymore.
Good old Steve Bruce. I suppose he is still Steve Bruce. Having said that, I suppose we say good old, Gareth Southgate. He is still Gareth Southgate. And, with all the criticism of the squad that he initially picked, actually a lot of people seem quite happy now that the likes of Jack Grealish and a couple of other players are in there, Chris. It's quite exciting to see this England team coming together.
Yeah, that absolutely is. I think what you're starting to see now is the fruits of that few year period we had where we won a lot of youth tournaments. And look, that's not always a precursor to tremendous success at senior international level. But you look at the likes of Phil Foden, who was a star in one of those games. You look at Jadon Sancho. Then you throw in someone like Jack Grealish, who was with the Irish setup at that point. You've got a lot of players that I think have a long-term future. And if you look at the teams that do well in major international tournaments, more often than not, you will find that it's because the core comes through at the same time. I think that was very much true of the Germany side that came through in 2009 at under 21 level that then went on to win the World Cup. There was a continuity there that I think benefited them considerably. So, yeah, the 30 years, 40 years, 50 years of hurt that we always hear about when we talk about England international level, I think it's closer to being over than it's ever been in my lifetime.
Very good point, actually. Yeah. It's also kind of fascinating to see what other countries are doing as well, because I think whilst we look at whilst we obviously look at the progression of England and we look at the likes of Sterling and Foden, and there are some fantastic players, it's not as if we exist in just a bubble. There are fantastic youth players also coming through in other countries, and sadly, maybe for England, France, Spain, Germany, even Italy at this point are transitioning into the next period. Maybe there is a hope that England are slightly ahead of the rest, or that their curve and their arc might be a little bit quicker than others. Thank you very much for listening to the Front Three. If you are interested in the Van der Beek transfer, or is it Van der Beek, Chris? I can't work out which one it is.
Van der Beek. Yeah, let's go with Van der Beek.
Back. Van der Beek. Van der Beek. It sounds better. It sounds more right. We've all been to Amsterdam for business. Not like that. Then please head over to the Statman Dave channel, who is a man who's very au fait with Amsterdam. Am I right, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah. You've never been, I'm guessing?
Just the airport.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I suppose you can still get that stuff there as well. Yeah, it is a fantastic location. I went in the winter, particularly cold, and with my girlfriend. So we all know that I went for the romance rather than, of course, the prostitutes that I keep alluding to. Anyway, let's move on and not upset Adam Boltwood anymore. Keep this under the hour, he said. Well, here we are, Kristen. We kept it under the hour. Congratulations.
Proud of us.
Big writing topics this week?
None that I can think of. All that jumped into my head was, what's the point?
Wow.
And you can't put that in 600 words.
No. Well, no, you could. You could just write it continually. Although, yeah, again, probably not. It's been wonderful to spend a bit of time with you. It's been wonderful to spend time in your guys' ears as well. If you aren't already sort of following Kristen on social media platforms, especially Twitter, head over there, take a look. It is a very well curated account. And if you aren't already following the Front Three, go ahead and take a look. If you're not already subscribed, which I kind of assume that you are at this point, then please go over to Apple Music, Spotify, and all the normal platforms. Go take a look at that, and we'll see you again real soon right here on the Front Three.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.